Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of In Forum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. I'm Scott Schaefer of KQED Public Radio. The percentage of families with children in San Francisco has been falling since 1960. Today, about 19% of the households here include children under the age of 18. That's one of the lowest percentages in the United States. Recent surveys suggest that nearly half the families with preschool children say that they plan to leave San Francisco in the next few years. The main reasons they cite include cost of living, especially the lack of affordable housing, the quality of public schools, stagnant job growth, and concerns over public safety. And so tonight we'll examine this trend, what's behind it, the implications of having fewer children living here, and what, if anything, can be done to reverse it. And our distinguished panel will take your questions after we have a conversation among ourselves here. Our guests this evening, Gwen Chan, she's the interim superintendent of the San Francisco Unified School District. She's a product of the school district and has also been a career educator in it for more than 38 years. Amit Ghosh is the Chief of Comprehensive Planning for the San Francisco Planning Department. He's leading the citywide action plan to address San Francisco's challenges for managed urban growth and affordable housing. John Kalacki is Program Officer for Arts and Culture at the San Francisco Foundation. Previously, he served as Executive Director of the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. And Nathan Naiman is the Executive Director of the Committee on Jobs. That's a coalition of San Francisco's largest private sector employers that want to improve job growth and economic vitality in the city. Well, let me begin by asking each of you, what difference does it make that families, especially families with younger children, are leaving San Francisco and say that they will be leaving San Francisco in the next few years? Why should we care? Gwen Chan?
This is our city. We care about our children and youth, and I feel very strongly that our city has a lot to offer, not only in terms of the educational opportunities, but the arts, the cultures, the diversity in our population. I really believe that this is a beautiful city to live and to be raised in.
But wouldn't it be a beautiful, lovely, wonderful city without kids or with fewer kids? Not because of that, necessarily.
I wouldn't be in education if I didn't like children. So, no, I really believe in preparing our future generation of children to be productive citizens, and I believe the school plays a very large role in that.
Okay. Amit Ghosh, your thoughts.
I would agree with Gwen. Cities are a wonderful place to bring up children. This is where I think you can afford children a civilized exposure to the world. This is kind of the microcosm of the world, and cities can be and are a wonderful environment in which to grow people. And the trouble that cities face is not that they are bad places for children, because a child-friendly city is friendly to all. It's not that they are bad places for families, but that there are certain constraints that come with the other advantages that come with the city that I'm sure we will get into.
John Kalacki.
You know, to me, it's not just the families that are thinking about leaving. To me, with my artistic kind of lens on, I see our artists in this community can't even afford to imagine living here and working here. And so once they begin imagining having families, they leave. I mean, they've already left the city. They've already gone to the East Bay. But once they start thinking about if they want to raise children, they have to go further away. And so to me, it's a huge kind of social, creative, intellectual, creative capital that's being lost both right now, but in the next generation. I think the next 10 years we're going to see tremendous flight.
And artists, from your perspective, are leaving primarily because of costs?
Yeah, we did some research, and I'll go into some of the details later about it, but we surveyed 1,000 artists living in the Bay Area, and These are people who have college or graduate degrees. They're very involved in their community. Two-thirds of them are earning less than $7,000 a year from their art practice and working, obviously, multiple jobs to stay here. But the average income of these artists is $35,000. So these are highly educated, highly involved, creative people that sort of is a magnet to keep people in the city, and they can't possibly afford to live here.
And so, the fact that they're leaving is that they're leaving for some of the same reasons that families are leaving, namely cost of living. But does the fact that they're leaving make San Francisco in some way a less hospitable place or less interesting place for families with kids?
Well, you know, Richard Florida touted us as one of his great examples 5 or 6 years ago in the rise of the creative class, saying it was the bohemian, as he called it, culture of San Francisco that allowed the software people to want to come here and have a vibrant city. And so if we imagine 10 years from now that there's not the next emergent class of artists here, there's not going to be the jazz clubs, there's not going to be the book readings, at Stacy's, the authors aren't going to be here, and it's going to be a wasteland that's paved over with, BMWs.
Nathan Naiman, your thoughts.
Well, I think that cities, cities are made up of people. Cities are organisms. They thrive in order to exist. And there are certain components that help organisms thrive and grow. I would say that kids are probably the most critical component of a city, because the future of a city is based upon your children. People that are parents, or even if you're not a parent but know a child, you look in that child's eyes and you think of the future, and what does the future have to give to this individual who is being nurtured. In this city, we try to give our children, I have a 10-year-old, we try to give our children as much as we can in talking about diversity, letting them know about different cultures, and it's what we give them that will shape the future of this city. As John just said, we want it to continue to be something that is vivacious, something that gives back at the same time as taking it. So when children leave and families leave, we're missing out on a future.
Is there something about the economy in San Francisco? And, of course, you can't segregate San Francisco from the rest of the Bay Area, but is there something about San Francisco from your perspective and the kinds of jobs that are here and the kinds of jobs that are being generated that contributes to the loss of families?
Well, we know that we've lost hundreds of thousands of jobs in the Bay Area over the last several years. And the economy is the driving force or the driving component of whether families are going to be capable of staying in San Francisco. We, from the position of my association, we see San Francisco having doubled its budget, its general operating budget, in the last 7 years or so, from $2.5 billion to over $5.3 billion. We continue to...
Let me just stop you there. And what about that?
Well, what about that is that we are spending lots of money, and in order to spend that money, we need to bring in more revenue. And the way that you do that is by taxes and fees, and that is sending people out because they can't afford it.
I just want to encourage each of the panelists, if there's something you want to say, don't wait for me to call on you. You don't have to be good boys and
I
girls.
I wanted to get back to the issue of costs and constraints. And let me get it out of my chest first. If we believe that we will be able to provide in cities what can be, say, provided in the physical structure of arrangement of a place, say, in the suburbs, that are conducive to families. If we equate a family-friendly being what a physical arrangement of the suburbs equate to, then I think that's not in the cards. In an urban area, you just cannot provide that. But it's because we are an urban area, it's because of our urbanity that we can provide the other aspects that are not available anywhere else. And that's why it's so important for kids to grow up in cities. It's not possible to be able to provide the picket fence image of an American family everywhere in the city. It's just not in the cards. However, it's the agglomeration and the densities and intensity of uses that this agglomeration leads to that then lets you avail of the advantages of a place like San Francisco's urbanity. The intensity allows you to then have access to a lot of different amenities that can be packed close in, and it's diverse. It's not just diverse in terms of culture and ethnicity. It's diverse in terms of the amenities that are available to people and children that are growing up. So the urban context is a very different context, and families have to make a choice whether they prefer the urbanity that's offered in cities or they prefer the bucolic imitations in a suburb. So that's something that people need to really make a choice about.
But there's also the certain realities. For example, if you have kids, they have to go to school. Mm-hmm. And you have a choice. Are they going to go to a public school? Are they going to go to a private school unless you want to homeschool them? Gwen Chan, one of the reasons that is often cited by families that leave or say they're going to leave is that they don't have faith in the public school system in San Francisco. Is it a perception problem or a reality or some combination of both?
I think it's a perception problem. I have been on the job for 2 months, and during this time, I have visited many, many, many schools, and there's good teaching and learning taking place in our schools. I believe that in general, there needs to be a better marketing on our end. We're not professionals in terms of how to market our schools, but we do need to do a better job of getting the word out as to what's happening in our schools. And it is from word to mouth that some of our schools become popular or not.
Give us some evidence that the schools are better than people think they are.
Well, for the second year in a row, the state of California has recognized us as the top urban school district in terms of academic performance based on API growth scores.
API means?
Academic Performance Index, sorry. And nationally, we've been recognized as the top urban school district by the Brill Foundation. So we're steadily improving in our teaching and learning, not to say that there aren't some areas of improvement that we need to work on in some of the schools.
Naaman, what do you hear from employers or people you're trying or the businesses are trying to recruit to San Francisco? I imagine that they care about the schools.
Certainly. When businesses recruit talent to come into San Francisco, one of the things that we do have is we have a highly educated workforce in San Francisco, and I believe we're all proud of that with the universities that we have. However, when the recruitment takes place, the two most important questions that are asked of the people coming to interview for their jobs is the cost of housing and the quality of the schools.
What do they tell them?
They are profound impediments for the hiring process because the housing is expensive as it is. People will be moving from, as Amit says, you know, other parts that might have the white picket fence mentality, but they do want to come into the city and live in the city. And what they find is that the pricing for housing, because of the market that we have, you know, the supply versus demand has driven up the housing costs, even with the foam or the bubble bust that people are talking about, to be incredibly high, which requires a premium in the salary. And once that premium is hit, again, there's less number of jobs that can be created. And when you talk about the education, the word is starting to get out about the quality of the schools. There are these hidden gems that exist, and they're excellent. But at the same time, that perception needs to change in order to be able to attract these folks.
What does that mean, hidden gems?
Some of the schools. The names are escaping me right now, but I'm of the index that did come out talked about Alvarado School and some other schools that people don't make as their first choice. Usually it's the well-known Lowell High School or some of the others like that. But the ones that don't become the first choice of families are the ones that are still looking for people to and families to come to those schools. And it's really driven by the principals, as we're learning. The business community has been very engaged in the school in schools, public school system and trying to help it be nurtured and get the revenue that it needs in order to move forward. And there are these principals out there that really work hard, and I know that Gwen was once one of them as well. Mm-hmm. They work hard. They're their own CEOs for those schools, and some of them are doing exceptional jobs.
To what extent is it an equation of if you have a certain amount of money to spend on housing and school, And maybe you can afford a house here, but then you can't afford private school as well. Or you can move to a cheaper place somewhere in the Bay Area, if you can find it, Tracy, or someplace out far. Well, it's become a bedroom community. You know, you can afford a house, and maybe, or you can afford a house there, and then you can maybe send your kids to the school. But it, to what extent is that? Are people coming here to work with, confronted with that? You know, I can't afford to do both, and I don't trust the schools enough to send my kid to a public school.
Yeah, I think it's a, great majority of the people that do come here. But the other thing that's interesting is, you know, well, John will talk about the artist community, for example. San Francisco has a high transient community, people that come in, spend some time, and then they leave. And what generally happens is that when those folks come in, they're usually in their 20s or somewhere around there, and they're looking to have a good time. I mean, I was one of those people, looking to have a good time, looking to make San Francisco, you know, what they all thought it was going to be in their lives. And then as they start growing from the perspective of getting a little bit older, wanting to meeting people, wanting to start a family, wanting to own a home, the things that seem to happen generally in our culture, there seems to be impediments and barriers to that happening as easy as it is in other places in this city. And whether, as Amit says, there shouldn't be the perceptions of the suburban, you know, mentality in San Francisco, people that do consider themselves urban dwellers are still faced with that challenge and at some point have to make the decision whether they're going to leave or stay. And that's the tipping point that we all face.
As a city planner, Amit, how do you think about these issues? What can a planner do?
I mean, Nathan's absolutely right. I mean, that's the choice that people are making, families are making. I mean, if you look at the total cost of housing, it is not less expensive, perhaps, to live somewhere else than in San Francisco. You'd live in a different kind of environment, more house, for that matter. But the choice that you're making is that you will save money on the schooling, that you will perhaps lay out more on transportation, but you would have an environment where, at least at a certain age, the kids will be safe and have a good school to go to. Those choices need to be made available in San Francisco. And it's not just housing and not just the affordability of housing. Affordability of housing is a huge challenge, and perhaps we will get into it in a place like San Francisco. But it has to be community building. You can plop houses in San Francisco, and that will not convince communities to grow by themselves or convince families to live in such communities unless there are all the other amenities that go along with a house. There has to be safe streets, safe parks, good schools, child care, access to health care. You name it, you know, all the other things that, but we don't, I mean, I'll point out, though, that we don't do so badly when you compare apples to apples. When you compare San Francisco to other Bay Area cities, then the numbers don't really show us in a good favor.
In but terms of?
In terms of, in terms of, oh, I'm missing.
Cost of housing or the number?
Well, it's kind of in terms of
quality of life. Sorts
quality
of
life indicators. But if you, and I'll get, as soon as it comes back to me, I'll get back to that. But if you look at the lot of children in San Francisco that can afford to live in San Francisco, they're not doing that badly. You know, if you compare ourselves to similar cities, you know, where it's an urban intense environment, we rank fairly high. And if you compare ourselves to those cities, you know, we have excellent access to certain community facilities. We have access to parks. We have access to schools. And we come out fairly high. As a matter of fact, there was a survey of good cities to live in, and San Francisco came out fourth. So even though we hear that families are leaving by the droves, and yes, they are, but you need to parse that information to see who exactly is being hurt by what we've got to offer.
Scott, can I just jump
Nathan,
in?
Name and shirt.
There's just one other point here. Again, it's what we're left with. It's that small number of families and small number of kids. And I think that's what this discussion is really about. You know, there are some people, I believe the Bay Area Economic Forum and the Bay Area Council have come out with some reports recently over the last couple of years, and there's actually been some finger-pointing to San Francisco as being the cause for some of the transportation problems we do have in the region and with urban sprawl. Because, again, as I mentioned earlier, the quality, I mean, the educational attainment of most of the people living in San Francisco is so high. Businesses and corporations, whether they're large or small, want to tap into the talent that exists here. And when they try, when the folks try to live here and just live their lives, they are not capable of doing it, and then they need to leave the city for the reasons we're talking about, and that precipitates transportation and gridlock and people coming over the Bay Bridge, and again, just the roads and the pollution, quite frankly, that exists after that as well. And then ultimately, when we're talking about having parks and having open space and things of that nature, it's the quality of those facilities that are available as well. And we know that the Neighborhood Parks Council does their own surveys with people who can go into the parks and actually rate them on their own. And the parks in San Francisco get less than a D rating, generally speaking, by most of the people that use the parks. So, again, where's our revenue going to in order to sustain the desire for people to want to stay in the city?
One of the things that with John Kalacki, please go ahead.
Yeah, I want to keep my art hat on here. And when Amit was talking, I was thinking, well, maybe the soccer mom and dads have an easier time in the suburbs. But, you know, my experience are the fierce moms and dads who are bringing their kids to the Nutcracker rehearsals or to the ODC rehearsals or to the community music school. You know, and we have our symphony orchestra, one of the great ones in the world, that every kid in every single elementary school has four interactions with that symphony orchestra every single year. So by the time a kid's in fifth grade, they've 20 different times with our musicians, and every kid goes to Davie Symphony Hall for free every year. And so the fierce moms and dads that I see wouldn't dare dream not being here when the opera's going to the schools, when the ballet's going to the schools, when they can study Afro-Cuban dancing two blocks away from where they're studying jazz music. So, you know, and that's why I think it's really important for us to really look at not only the families, but how this city is supporting the arts. I mean, we have about 220 arts groups that this city is supporting. The city this year put in $52 million into the arts groups, which is just really amazing. But I went back, and, you know, in year 2000, we were all talking about the Gold Rush just as a long time ago. We were talking about the Gold Rush, and the same things happened. No one earned money in that Gold Rush. The streams were stripped of gold, and the big companies moved in, pushed the miners out, and, you know, the service industries came in. And we see that artist spaces were renting for $12 a square foot in 1999. Now, at the height, you know, it went up to about $55 a square foot. It's bounced down, but it's not anywhere near the $12. So a lot of the spaces that have been taken over by the artists in the 70s and 80s, they're gone now. There's not any new spaces for this next generation to take over. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really thinking, well, those urbanista parents that I know of with their kids who are demanding that their kids have culture in every part of their lives, you know, if the next groups aren't going to be there, it's not going to be as an appealing city. Mm-hmm.
There was a policy in the city in the late 80s to create more live-work space for artists to help them stay here, and a lot of artists moved into lofts, and now we've seen the whole concept of lofts being something very different. It's luxury housing, and I'm wondering, how did that happen? And, Amit Ghosh, from a planning perspective, did the city put the right emphasis, if we're going to build all this housing as we did in the 90s, the late 90s, mid to late 90s, was that the right mix? In other words, if you're going to have families here, you've got to have family housing, and families don't live in lofts.
Well, but, you know, it was the right emphasis. If you, like John said, if you want artists to live here, you have to have space for them that's affordable to artists.
But lofts aren't affordable for artists.
Exactly. That's where I think the thing went haywire. It was supposed to be, it wasn't supposed to be lifestyle housing. I mean, the intent was to have space for the arts community. in funky areas, gritty neighborhoods, that would support the arts and crafts. And this happened. I mean, artists move in all gritty neighborhoods, in everywhere. This is not a secret. It happened in Soho. And they are the forces that let real estate discover neighborhoods. Once the artists settle in, there go the neighborhoods. And you have, no matter how stringently you write rules, there are always ways that enterprising businesses and enterprising developers will figure out, and that's their job, figure out ways to get around it. Now, if you have live-work and it's a commercial use, it can go ahead in San Francisco in industrial areas without any review. So they, once they figured that out, then they figured out a product that could be approved in San Francisco without any review, and that is a free ticket, a free ride in San Francisco. If there is review, then the costs of producing housing goes up. If there is no review, then you don't waste time in producing the housing. So it got produced in the name of artists because artists, as John was just talking about it, refuse to be certified as artists because it kind of impinged on their rights to be artists, to be regulated. So everybody claimed to be an artist. Anybody and everybody can have a drawing board or whatever and claim that they are artists. And that's how live-work lofts became lifestyle housing, very expensive lifestyle housing, and it kind of got caught up in a perfect storm. The dot-com boom happened, and the lifestyle and the young folks who made a lot of money then, maybe they did not get to keep the money, as John pointed out, but, you know, they had a lot of money.
But they had fun.
That made it very, very expensive and that, not a housing proposition.
From a developer's perspective, though, that kind of housing is the most profitable. Two, three, four-bedroom bedroom housing for families is not as profitable for a whole host of reasons, one of which you describe, which is the process you have to go through. Another one has to do with the education tax, right, Gwen Chan? I mean, all these new houses, the lofts that went up, those developers didn't have to – I mean, that ends up hurting the school district in a way, doesn't it?
Well, actually, what we're looking into with the Board of Education and myself are ways to promote development of teacher housing, because that's one of the reasons why we can't retain many new teachers is because of the cost of housing.
But if we're going to build more housing for teachers and nurses and bus drivers and police officers and firefighters, you've got to put it somewhere, right? You've got to, and there isn't a lot of vacant land in San Francisco, and so one of the options is to go up, to increase density, to go higher up in the sky. And that seems to be, Nathan Lehman, it seems to be not very popular in this city.
Well, let me just jump in for a second, and I'll answer that question as well. You know, when Gwen talked about teachers, public safety, we'd like to have firefighters and police here instead of living in Petaluma.
Especially if there's
when we need them, especially talking about our centennial celebration coming up. You know, it's not the developers necessarily, it's not necessarily even the planning department, but it's the process. There's something very unique about San Francisco neighborhoods and San Francisco residents, and people talk about NIMBYs. You know, literally, you can have one person stop a project that the rest of a neighborhood or the rest of a community really embraces, and even with a recommendation by the Planning Commission that is embraced. And that one person can appeal the process, go to the Board of Supervisors, and literally stop the process dead in its tracks. And quite frankly, if you're a developer, if you have delays that take months and even years in some instances, you say to yourself, first of all, they're losing money because they do have to pay the bank for the capital project. And ultimately what happens is they say, you know, we really can start a project here because we don't know how long the process will take. There was a ballot initiative for workforce housing, which would have said for teachers, for nurses, for certain personnel in a certain part of the area, let's set up the rules and say these are the rules for you to build housing. And it was defeated. There was an expensive campaign against that.
Funded by?
The opposition.
Who did that include?
Well, it was a number of people. It was there was some folks in the residential builders group, and again, a number of people in that community that did not want to give up that right to be able to have one or two people appeal that process. And, you know, it is a challenge for the planning department, for everyone in the city, in order to create more housing, create a larger supply so we can have people stay here.
But, you know, there is land available. I mean, if we go to Baby Hunter's Point and we're watching the land grab that goes on now, their developers are descending in that neighborhood and grabbing up all the empty lots and stuff, and even the light rail project. There wasn't a lot of, I would say, thought about what makes a livable, sustainable community, even as the light rail went in there, about the affordable housing, about the schools, about the parks, about the health and human services, about the small businesses and the arts along that corridor. And I think that, you know, our city has to take responsibility. That has to be much more holistic about how we do this. I just spent
okay, I'll rise to the defense of the city here.
Okay.
Because we have...
We'll arm wrestle
we
over
have,
this one.
No, not, I mean, this is something that you're absolutely right, that this is what we have to do. I just want to update on what we are doing. You know, I mean, what Nathan pointed out and what John was talking about, we addressed kind of front and center through what was announced as the Citywide Action Plan. You all, I'm sure, have heard of the Better Neighborhoods Program. It's, like I said, I started out by saying that it's not just building housing. And no matter what the rumors are, you know, we have been building at a very fast clip. Traditionally, we have been lucky if we had produced 1,000 units of housing a year. In the last 5 years, we have pumped it up to about 5,000 units. I mean, last year, we approved 5,000 units. You won't believe this, but there are 25,000 units in the planning department's pipeline. That means there are 25,000 units that are being reviewed that will be approved. And then...
What percentage of that is family housing?
What percent of the family? Again, if you define it the way I would like to define it, in an urban area, we have to make some choices about family housing. A large percentage of that is family housing. And if you look at, get back to your point, Scott, in San Francisco, there is a large stock of family housing. Unfortunately, it's in the wrong place and stuck in the wrong time, because you have about 30%, a third of our housing stock, of about 350,000 housing stock total, a third is in single-family homes. You know, for a San Francisco dense urban area that's second dense to New York, that's a huge number. And unfortunately, that is not available to the demand for such housing stock. And it is also not affordable. So we need to look at new areas where we can build a lot of housing. And we are building... if you look at the pipeline, 25,000, the mayor just announced 15-5 program, where the objective is to build 15,000 units in the next 5 years, and I'm happy to report that last year we approved 5,000. This year we are way on our way to at least approve as much. So if we approve these units, what we need to now do is get back with what we are calling the Better Neighborhoods Program. One example of that is in the Downtown Neighborhoods Initiative, and we just approved the Rincon Hill Plan. And you won't believe this, but this plan took us several years to go through the agreements that needed to be reached, but it had a robust set of community building characteristics, not just the housing. It will produce tall towers, one of which is already under construction. It's the tallest residential tower in the city. It's about 600 feet tall. It has at the base a podium of about 85 feet, which then lends you to build family housing, walk-ups to a certain level, and then elevators. So there's a mix of housing in these new neighborhoods that we are transforming whole cloth. We are no longer allowing just live-work to be plopped anywhere on cheap dirt. We are requiring that there be housing that's planned according to the rules that are set up in these plans. And once that is done, and this is just an anecdote I'm going to tell you, that there were projects that are hundreds of feet tall, several hundred units in each. They were approved at the Planning Commission without years' worth of analysis and without long hearings at the Planning Commission, over only a discussion of 20 minutes.
But that is, a rarity, I mean.
And it is no longer a rarity because a rarity. Now that we have the plans, we are having projects come in. And that's what has really upped our numbers, Nathan. You know, it was before the plans, we were able to build about 1,000 units. Now that we have the Rincon Hill plan, the mid-market plan, the Market Octavia plan is coming along, these have the promise of building these 25,000 units, and the rules have been revised, if you look at it carefully, to cut down on the process altogether.
Scott,
because the decisions have been made.
Nathan.
When these were planned, did you look to see if there were any schools in the area?
We worked with the school district, and we worked out exactly the kind of school support would be needed, the kind of public parks would be needed, the streets need to be tamed to become pedestrian-friendly. These plans went with a package where there is a robust program of, since we are allowing a lot of development on a land that did not allow this development, what we have done is we have then, Nathan will complain about these, but we have now a fund created that through the development itself pays for about $25 a foot of each new development that we permit. $25 a foot goes towards building open space, goes towards building sidewalks, slowing down traffic, building large parks, small pocket parks, and affordable housing.
Yeah. Nathan, I want to give you 1 second. I just want to let people know that we're going to begin taking questions from the audience in just a few minutes. So if you have a question, feel free to line up at the microphone, and we'll get to that part in just a moment.
Yeah, first of all, there is no cheap dirt in San Francisco. I don't think there ever was, even in 1849. Again, the number of projects in the pipeline, that's great. How many get built? That's the real question. How many get built in order for families to live in the city? I find it interesting, when we talk about, quote-unquote affordable housing, it used to be called low-income housing, but now we're calling it affordable housing because of the relative term that it has. Because people that qualify for affordable housing would surprise a number of you in this audience. Just last week, the Bay Guardian wants to put a moratorium in front of the voters on all new market-rate housing. So, again, it's certain types of housing that can be qualified to be built in San Francisco, and that is part of the legislative process because, again, certainly lots of projects are getting appealed. They're being appealed to the Board of Supervisors where everything is politicized as opposed to the Planning Department and the Planning Commission, which are the Planning Department, Amit, has wonderful staff and good planners that are urban. They're urban planners. They understand how to move things forward. But because we have certain policies, legislative policies in this city that politicizes everything, it makes it harder to build these new units. And the fund that Amit said that I would be against, it's not about being against those funds. It's how the money is spent. And it should not be controlled by ward bosses. They should be spent citywide.
Well, let me give you a couple of examples of things the city is spending money on. For example, universal preschool. I think before this Rob Reiner Prop 82 was even qualified for the ballot, the city decided that as a policy matter, the city was going to spend money to provide preschool for all kids in the city. There is money from the general fund, not a lot, but some being put toward restoring the arts in public schools. Aren't those the kinds of things, Nathan, that would attract families? And yes, they're expensive, but isn't that what it's going to take, those kinds of things, to attract families here and keep them here?
Yeah, certainly. and those mitigation fees have been in San Francisco for years. The question is, what has been actually built for that money? Because those funds have been growing. They continue to be used. But again, we still, if you talk about the quality of the open space, as an example, as I gave, whether it's parks or the sidewalks or the cleanliness of the streets, some of that money has been going to be used for that, but we don't seem to ever have enough money to really meet the problem head on and solve it. And that is probably one of the more frustrating things about being a resident in the city. We continue, I think a parking meter is now 25 cents for 8 minutes, used to be a half hour. Our fees continue to rise, and we're being nickel and dime to death. And there seems to be enough money there. The developers are paying the money. Everyone is pitching in. But the question gets down to, you know, are you getting a dollar's worth for the money that you're putting into it?
And we still have bond measures to pay for street paving.
And again, those are the homeowners paying that. So that's a minority of the folks that are who live in the city are actually paying that fee.
John Kalacki, before we go to questions from the audience, if you could change one thing in the city, wave your magic wand, to make it more affordable, to make it things that were somewhat within reason, what would you do to make San Francisco more family-friendly?
I would have arts in every classroom every day in every school.
That's simple. How about you, Nathan?
I let there be more housing that's housing that will be available for middle-income folks. My son is in the San Francisco Boys Chorus, and he loves the arts. He's probably been to the museum more often than most adults in this town. So I agree with John, you know, more arts, using the money for what it was intended to and not necessarily for salary increases.
Amit?
Since it's always going to be expensive to do things in San Francisco, I would suggest that we, yes, build a lot of housing, but make sure that a large part of it is affordable to the folks that can earn a living in San Francisco.
Gwen Chan, quick word from you.
It's hard to say. It's like going to a candy shop and there's so many things to choose from. I would say getting parents involved, getting more community involvement in our schools. I would hope that would take place, because one of the things that we didn't talk about today really is the perception of the amount of violence in some of our communities and neighborhoods, and that is one reason why some people are choosing to leave our city. So to have that kind of partnership, because each school is a city within a city, and we need everyone involved to help make a safe school.
Well, for the benefit of our radio audience, let me just remind you that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club's In Forum program, and tonight we're asking the question, is San Francisco affordable for young workers and families? I'm Scott Schaefer of KQED Public Radio, and I'm here with Gwen Chan, Interim Superintendent of the San Francisco Unified School District, Amit Ghosh, he is the Chief of Comprehensive Planning for the San Francisco Planning Department, John Kalacki, Program Officer for Arts and Culture at the San Francisco Foundation, and Nathan Naiman. Have I been pronouncing your name correctly? No, I have been. Nathan Naiman, Executive Director of the Committee on Jobs. Let's go to the audience now, and you're first.
Thanks very much, Scott. I appreciate this forum. First, let me say that I am a parent. I have two children in public elementary school. To summarize what I've heard, there are two issues here, those who can afford to live in the city and those who cannot. For those who cannot afford to live in the city, apparently you're streamlining the building process. That's good. For those who can afford to live in the city but leave, the choice is often made because of schools. I think there's a perception that the school district is not good. In fact, I think it might be more than a perception. Ms. Chan earlier said that the school district is not in the business of marketing. With all due respect, I think your API score is your marketing. My children are nominally enrolled in the Gates program, Gifted and Talented program. I think there are a lot of parents who send their children to private school because they don't believe that there is the opportunity for their children, should they choose, should they demonstrate the talent, to be able to go on to perform well in public school. Earlier, there was a mention of Lowell High School and that being a choice. It's not really a choice. You test into it. What I would suggest is to recognize that there should be banding, which is something I'm sure Ms. Chan can explain, in San Francisco public schools, and there should be the opportunity to have gifted and talented programs or other incentives so that parents who can afford to live in the city but who choose to send their kids to private school or who then leave the city would stay if they had the opportunity to see that their children can go on to do great things in the public school.
Gwen, you want to respond?
I wasn't sure what the question was, but in terms of marketing, I didn't say that we don't care to invest in that. I'm just saying we're probably not doing as good a job as we can.
Isn't that part of the superintendent's job, to be the cheerleader and let everybody
know, when I'm not settling labor disputes and trying to maintain fiscal stability and also taking care of age buildings, yeah.
Well, and you bring up a good point because the teachers are very close to striking. They've mm-hmm. authorized a strike. Mm-hmm. What effect is that going to have on people who are thinking of leaving or thinking of sending their kids to a public school? I think
well,
we know the answer.
We're constantly we're still in the mediation stage. It's unfortunate that the union leadership has decided to take us a premature strike authorization vote at this time. There is actually a PERB rule.
Should the mayor get involved?
He's offered if both sides would like it, and I have a meeting with him tomorrow. I plan to ask for his assistance. I'm hopeful. I really am, because I don't believe, having gone through three strikes myself in the 70s, particularly in 79 when it lasted 6 weeks, I saw students become disengaged. Parents very anxious, worry about the safety of their children who were sometimes not going to school at that time, especially in the senior high division. I know we have some retired administrators sitting out there, and they can probably share stories, horror stories of the six-week strike back in 79. No, we don't want that to happen again.
Okay. Scott, can I just throw one other remark? To answer your question, one of the other components that goes unnoticed and works behind the scenes, there are a number of business civic leaders in San Francisco that are so passionate and committed to the public school system. They were the ones that helped raise the funds necessary to pass the ballot initiative that provided up to $60 million out of the general fund of San Francisco that will go exclusively to school for the arts and after-school programs. Those types of ballot initiatives do not pass on their own, and the funds mm-hmm. for the campaigns were primarily provided by members of the business community that, again, have this passion for the public school system in San Francisco.
And I understood that to go to a specific school, the Gates program my children are in receives nominally $400 a year. That's the sum total of their budget. That is an easy thing to deal with an increase and an incentive to get children into this program.
Okay, why don't we let some other people ask some questions? Thank you. Yes?
My question is a small matter compared to the big matters that are facing the San Francisco public schools, and I think it has to do with the perception of violence. I'm a Muni rider, and as a result of the interaction that I observe on Muni buses by public school students, I feel I wouldn't want my children in public schools. I never knew what heroin looked like until overhearing middle school girls describing it to other kids. The language that is the regularly used language among the kids is horrific.
But is that the fault of the schools, or is that the fault of the families and our culture and a whole bunch of other things?
And this is a good point, because it's the community building, and it's working between the parents and the schools and the kids to talk about, well, what is acceptable public behavior and what is acceptable public language. But it is very startling to hear and observe the kids.
Gwen Chan, I imagine you have a different perspective, or at least a fuller one.
sharing the blame. I do believe it is not just the school's responsibility. One of the things upon coming into this office was my fervent desire to bring back into the curriculum character education. I really believe it has to start young, has to start in the home. If that doesn't happen in the home, then we can reinforce this in the schools in terms of teaching our children discipline, respect for differences of opinion, sacrificing for a long-term goal. There's just so many elements, academic honesty. I think that it can't be practiced in every single classroom. And I hear you in terms of what I take the Muni too sometimes. I don't have a chauffeur. I take the Muni, and it's not a pleasant thing to experience. But you know what? Sometimes they're not public school students.
Or sometimes they've dropped out. From the business community's perspective, is the school district putting the emphasis in the right places? Now, some of it, of course, is being driven by the state and federal governments and testing requirements and so on, but Are the schools on the right track?
Again, I think that the core for the future of the schools really resides in the principals and at the schools. And I think that there's been a big emphasis and a large commitment for that. Sadly enough, it's the leadership, the school board itself, that tends to get tied up in political matters that are not necessarily in the best interest of the children. I don't think Gwen could have said that, and I was the one that needed to say it. But I think, genuinely speaking, that is one of the key issues here. Who's looking out for the kids day in and day out, and what type of policy direction and strategic planning is initiated? And that needs to come from less of an ideological bent, but more on an educational bent.
Should the mayor take over the schools, like Villaraigosa is trying to do in L.A.?
And they did in New York and also Chicago.
Chicago, with mixed results.
Yeah, there will always be mixed results, but it's certainly an idea worth considering. I don't think people are there yet in this town.
Okay. Gwen, I'm sure you have thoughts about that, but let's get back to the questions.
Hi. I agree with Gwen Chan that there are wonderful, devoted teachers in San Francisco Unified. But we have one of the highest percentages in the country of these people that know the system better than anyone that send their own children to private schools, which they can ill afford. To what do you attribute this?
Your question was, why are they sending their children?
What is your opinion of why we have one of the highest percentages in the country of public school teachers who send their own children to private school when we know the system very well?
I can't answer that for a teacher who I myself sent my children to public schools, but I do hope that teachers would consider sending their children to the public schools. In fact, there is a resolution that's coming up before the board in terms of giving priority to student placements for teachers who work in our system to have the children attend the schools that they are teaching in.
Did you say you're a public school teacher?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, and where do you get that data that we have the highest one of the highest
percentages? It was in the Examiner that it was one of the highest in the country.
You know, I'd ask the question, you know, what percentage of public school teachers live in San Francisco?
Yeah.
And if we take a look at that percentage and then try to do our own little analysis of that, maybe they're not sending them to public school because they're not living here.
No, or they're sending them to public school. Nathan should be our marketing agent. He's really good.
Yes, sir.
Hi, question about the entering into the housing market here. So one way, which is one of the easier ways to enter in the housing market, is through TICs. This question primarily for Amit, maybe for Nathan, but going into a TIC and then ultimately converting to a condo. But the process here is so onerous. I mean, I've never heard of anything like it in any other city in the U.S. where you're waiting, even for a duplex, you wait 3 years these days, and for, you know, a triplex or quad or something, you're waiting 7+ years. So why is that? Why don't we simplify the process, make it easier for people to, middle class, upper middle class people, to enter the housing market?
Isn't that one of the reasons, though, that TICs are less expensive? Because they know they're going to have to go through that awful process.
Yes, and that's by design, too. In any case, the TICs, I believe, are an excellent way to, under the circumstances, to have folks get the opportunity to own something. But at the same time, the housing stock that the TICs depend on is the rental housing stock. And whether you hate it or love it, rent control, you know, has a lot of our rental stock in the realm of affordability, holds the rental stock in the realm of affordability. So that's the tension, that how much of the city's affordable rental stock gets opened up, you know, through TICs. And it again is that once bitten, twice shy, the live-work phenomenon reminds us of innovative ideas that go wrong. So we are taking a very cautious approach to making sure that it's not taken advantage of. You
know? What's the downside? I mean, San Francisco has about 65% of its residents are renters, which is relatively high. What's the downside of that?
It's not relatively high when you compare, again, apples to apples, you know, like in New York.
Cities like Boston and New York are comparable.
Right.
But it's still high for the country.
Absolutely. And even in the Bay Area, you know, it's high. But that's, again, one of the characteristics of San Francisco. If you look at what gives San Francisco color? It's people. And people need to be able to live in San Francisco to be its people. And if you get rid of the rental stock, and if everybody's, and there is a higher percentage of ownership, you get folks that are not as free and footloose and artistic. So the kind of the characteristic of San Francisco, it also comes into question as to whether that can be sustained. So that's, again, a policy choice that people in San Francisco need to make.
Well, I question that assumption, though, too. I mean, is that assumption proven out in many other cities where condo conversion is run so much faster, where it's a non-issue, effectively? I mean, it seems like this is kind of an outdated concept that, you know, no one's been questioning, and now it's really difficult for, you know, people, unless they're millionaires, to just enter the basic housing market.
Yeah. Scott, can I just jump
in? Nathan, sure.
Yeah, you're a perfect example of an individual that wants to become a homeowner and is being thwarted through ideology that exists, you know, in our city. There's a maximum of 500 TICs that are allowed in San Francisco, and we talked about the ideology component of this. When Ami talks about rent control, there are some people talking about means testing for rent control, making sure that what rent control was originally set up for is being used the way it was originally set up for. And if there was the allowance of building more housing, rental housing or any kind of housing, we wouldn't be having this problem. So, again, I think that there's certainly a legislative agenda that's limiting the supply side, which is causing the problems we're seeing.
But I can only add that we are doing our very best to open up the supply, and you can just look at the numbers, and it's just amazing. I was quoted in the newspaper that I'm amazed. The numbers are amazing because I am amazed at how well we are doing in terms of producing housing in a very difficult situation like San Francisco. But getting back to your, you know, there is this, there's a cause and effect and a cost and a benefit. Yes, there is through TICs, home ownership can be fostered. But at whose expense? That also needs to be looked at. You know, whether if that were allowed unfettered, you know, where would we really end up? And is that a place we want to be?
Thank you.
But, Amit, I'm looking down at your notes here, and I
careful what you're writing, Amit.
$240,000 annual income needed for a median-priced house of $760,000, I think,
terrible.
Goes to the point that the man who was just at the microphone, it's like the bar is now so high for people to even imagine that we can own something in this city, mm-hmm. to kind of put roots down, mm-hmm. that it's getting more and more elusive. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that's...
When you get down to brass tacks, you know, that's what it takes. You know, it's amazing, yes. $241,000 to afford the median-priced home. You know, think about that. So what are we talking about here in terms of being affordable to folks who need to be able to live here because they work here? How much money do artists make? Where will they live if the median-priced home is this? So it is expensive, and what we, I guess, are kind of begging the question here is that how do we pay for what it takes to live in a city like San Francisco?
Build more housing.
We haven't talked about it much tonight, but it's interesting to see who's leaving San Francisco. And among the communities leaving the quickest are African Americans, right. Some of whom are buying houses in places like Vallejo, cashing in. Actually, Bayview Hunters Point, right. I think, has one of the highest home
ownership. Very high ownership.
Mm-hmm. The highest in the city.
Many of those families are cashing out and moving in. And it's changing the racial demographics of that community as mm-hmm. well. So there's a lot of tension going on in Bayview.
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. I have a 4-year-old son, and my husband and I moved to San Francisco to raise our son in an urban environment. We wanted him to experience the urbanity. Before that, we were living in Houston, Texas. So we moved out here after he was born. It's been great. We live in a terrific street. We love our neighborhood. Here's the deal. There's 6 kids on our street, 5 and under. The 5-year-old family was very... supportive of the public schools. They believed in the public schools. You're lucky tonight, though, that the mom's not here. Because they did the whole lottery thing, put all their faith in it. There's one of these small gyms 4 walking blocks from our street, They did not get into that one. They did not get into their other four top choices. So they're faced with either shipping their five-year-old on a 45 to 60-minute Muni commute or driving across the town instead of walking the four blocks. And it's very foreseeable that the six children who are 3 to 5 on our street will not be going to the six same schools. And so how do you establish a community and a city within a city for a school when you have that situation right here in the city?
Really important question.
The problem with that is, and I hear you, although you won't believe my statistics, that 84% of the families that put in their first choice got the seven choices, whereas 62% got the first choice. The problem in your situation that I'm guessing is that you all apply for the same school. For example, at Lincoln High School.
But this is the one that's four blocks from our street.
I understand.
And it's a small gym. It's not rooftop.
I was just going to finish explaining. I understand. When I was principal at Lincoln High School, there were students that were living across the street that couldn't get in because annually there are about 3,000 applicants for 500, 600 seats. So that it is through the lottery, as you mentioned, and it really is not a plan. The diversity plan or the lottery plan, as it's called, is something that is being reviewed, and we will have the Board of Education will have a new plan in effect in a year for the 07-08 school year.
Why is it a disadvantage to have everybody on the block applying to the same school?
Because if there are only so many seats, then everybody's applying for that same school.
But none of them got it.
Well, no, this was just, that was the oldest one, other kids.
One applied.
That's my fear, and that's my concern, because
Got it.
62% is not very high. I mean, that's, 38% aren't getting their top choice?
The first choice.
Right.
60%.
Right, the one that's four blocks
from the
house.
The first choice. One out of.
And I mean, I moved here because we wanted to have one car, we wanted to take public transportation, and, you know, yet we may have to forego all of that, a lot of the advantages of our vanity.
Okay. Thank you very much for the question. Yes, sir.
My name is John O'Brien. I work for Coleman Advocates for Children and Youth in San Francisco. And we actually just put out a report about families in San Francisco. And we found that there's really a distinction between people who can kind of choose to leave for a different lifestyle and low and moderate income folks who really are just getting pushed out and priced out. We found that 60% of families who left between 95 and 2000 were low or moderate income people. So I want to talk about, I understand the issue of, do you want a suburban lifestyle? Do you want an urban lifestyle? What about generations of folks who have tried to, you know, they already have roots in the city and they're really being forced out and the fabric of the city is changing? What can be done about that?
Let me just say we've got about 4 minutes left, so I want to try to get the last question as well, but I'm sure these folks will stick around afterwards and you can talk with them further.
Like, we have to have a very strong housing program that fits the needs of these people that need to be in San Francisco. And, you know, there's no denying the fact that we will have to find the money. It's going to be expensive, you know, but we have to build, use the market as much as we can, use the strength of the market to make sure that there is enough in the mix so that it remains a diverse mix. And then, you know, we are blessed with perhaps the strongest nonprofit housing sector anywhere. And they build about 25%. And it's a very difficult task, and it's also very expensive because of all the obstacles that we have. And with federal and state monies drying up, it becomes even more expensive. And we are trying to figure out every which way to kind of engage the market in producing below market rate housing. And that's the answer. And I don't know, I mean, we will never be able, I believe, with the instruments that we have dreamed up so far, meet the total need for housing in San Francisco.
Scott, can I just jump in?
Quick question. Yeah.
There's a thing in San Francisco called inclusionary housing, and it requires a certain percentage of housing to be below market rate whenever housing is built in San Francisco. There are members of the Board of Supervisors that want to kick that up to over 20%. So that means that 20% of whatever is built, 20% of that has to be below market rate housing. when a developer tries to work out the numbers to see whether it pencils out, it becomes extremely challenging, almost impossible. There's been some people that say instead of going up to 20%, so it's a 5% increase from the existing inclusionary housing rate, make that targeted exclusively for middle-income folks in San Francisco. When you present that to the legislative body in San Francisco, they won't even call a hearing on it to even talk about it. So I think the people listening to this broadcast, people in this audience, need to weigh in with their supervisors, their district supervisors. They need to hear from you.
But they have agreed, Nathan, to allow us to do the analysis for what is really feasible. Because if you have much lower income included in your market rate housing, then you need more money for the same house than if you have, say, moderate income. So what Nathan is talking about makes good sense to kind of target our different avenues of producing affordable housing so that we get the biggest bang for the buck. So in order to produce more housing at the medium income level, if we use the market, we perhaps will be more successful. But at this point, the board has really charged us to do an analysis of exactly what it costs to develop these different kinds of affordable housing.
Are we doing enough to help nonprofit developers?
Not enough. But, you know, we're trying our best.
Yeah. I'm afraid we're out of time. I apologize. We didn't get to your question. Let's give a big hand to the panelists for their thoughts here tonight. And now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. 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 Is adjourned.